following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
The story is told that as General Lee was marching his troops up the Chambersburg Road towards Gettysburg, there was a lady in the village who took it upon herself to grab the poker from her fireplace and ran out in the street to challenge the rebels. Of course, they didn't pay any mind to her. They just kept right on marching towards the battlefield. But after the war was over, years later, a group of those village ladies got together and they were holding a quilting circle. And in that number was the lady who had run out in the street with her poker from her fireplace. And some of the ladies were teasing her a little bit. And they said, "What in the world did you expect to do with your little poker against the whole army in Northern Virginia?" And the lady looked back at him and said, "Well, I didn't expect to do anything. But I sure let them know whose side I was on, didn't I?" When it comes to Jesus, it's hard to remain neutral. He doesn't really leave us that option. Jesus says to us, "Follow me." But then he leads us in directions that we never expected. He leads us out of the familiar, out of the comfortable, out of the convenient. And we have to choose. Are we really in or are we out? Do we really trust him enough to follow him there? Which side are you on? And does the rest of the world know it? We kind of see this dilemma illustrated in the passage we're going to look at today, Mark 3, verses 7 through 12. And if you haven't already turned there, I encourage you to take your Bible and turn to that right now, Mark 3, verses 7 through 12. It's an unusual kind of passage. I dare say you've probably not heard many preachers preach on this text. And you'll understand why as we read it. Because in Mark 3, verse 7, we pick up the story. Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, from Jerusalem, from Idumea, beyond the Jordan, the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him. For he healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. Now, let me just give you a little context here so the rest of what we talk about this morning will make a little sense. Because this is not one of those passages that easily divides into 3 points in a poem. There's no big life lessons out of this passage. Rather, Mark 3, 7 through 12 serves as kind of a hinge between two different sections of Mark's gospel. Mark shares a summary of Jesus' ministry that bridges between his description of the beginning of Jesus' ministry and the description of the expansion of Jesus' ministry. And in this unusual passage, we see several themes. If you've been with us since we started the study, there are several themes that Mark's kind of drawing in here. He's drawing in the theme, the motif of Jesus withdrawing from the countryside or from the cities into the countryside, the wilderness. He has the presence of Jesus' disciples. He has the great crowds being drawn to Jesus. He has Jesus exercising divine authority over both physical disease and spiritual oppression. And he's got Jesus encountering resistance from the religious establishment. Now, that one's a little more subtle, but it's there, as we're going to unpack in just a moment. After all, it was the repeated confrontations between Jesus and those religious leaders that precipitated his decision to withdraw. However, Mark also looks ahead in this passage to some things, some new threads that he's going to weave into the story. We're going to see in the next few weeks, we're going to see Jesus' disciples expand from about 4 men to 12. The 12 we normally think of. We're going to see Jesus' reach begin to expand beyond Galilee to the entire nation of Israel. And we're going to see the opposition of Jesus continue to build until it culminates in his crucifixion. But this is kind of a hinge that ties those two halves of the story together. Now, nevertheless, even though that's really kind of a hinge or kind of a summary, there are some things in this passage, some observations that we can draw out about Jesus' ministry. And the events in Mark's summary help to illustrate these general observations that we can make concerning Jesus' work. And so I just want to point these things out to you today to give you some food for thought, to see where you are in this story. One of the first is this: when Jesus' work is resisted, he withdraws from those who are resisting. As Mark tells us there in verse 7, Jesus withdrew to the sea. Now, it's no accident that Mark places this withdrawal immediately after his description of how the religious leadership and the political leadership had decided to join forces to get rid of Jesus. If you back up to verse 6, he talks about the Pharisees, the spiritual leadership, and the Herodians, the political leadership, deciding Jesus has got to go. These are two normally enemies. They were normally at cross purposes with each other, but they were agreed on the fact Jesus was upsetting the apple cart, and they had to do something about it. As one commentator has described it, Jesus here is making a tactical withdrawal. He's not running away, but he's making a tactical withdrawal out of the synagogues. Jesus left the arena where the religious establishment dominated, and he moves into the public square where he could literally go over the heads of the religious leadership and appeal directly to the people. This withdrawal fits a pattern that we see in the scriptures. If a people resist God and resist what Christ is doing, he moves on to where people are more responsive. Hear me on that. As Jesus would later tell his followers in Mark chapter 6, he's sending his disciples out on a preaching tour, and he gives them this advice, what to do when they encounter resistance. In Mark 6:11, any place that does not receive you or listen to you, as you go out from there, shake the dust off your feet for a testimony against them. In other words, if the door's closed, don't just keep pounding on the door. You go find one that's open. Go find people where people are responsive. Shake the dust off your feet and move on. Also in Mark 6, probably the event that precipitated those instructions, Mark's going to tell us about the chilling response Jesus received in his hometown, in Nazareth. We're told that he visited Nazareth, and Mark 6 verse 5, he could do no miracle there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he wondered at their unbelief. Mark also tells us that what happens here is, you know, these people were looking, they'd heard all the stories about Jesus, and they kept saying to themselves, wait a minute, is this the same kid that grew up here? I mean, we know his parents. We know his siblings. Is this the same kid? And so because they had him pigeonholed, they didn't have the faith to believe in what he was doing, and as a result, he didn't do much there in his own hometown. Now, I don't believe that lack of faith literally prevented Jesus from exercising his authority. It's like, that's the juice he needed to be able to do what he did. I think instead, I mean, it's like this: if people lack the faith to recognize what you're doing, why bother? Go somewhere where they will appreciate it. As the writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 11:6, without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God, get this, must believe that he is, and that he's the rewarder of those who seek him. These people were not willing to believe. They didn't have the faith. They weren't open to the possibility. So as a result, they missed out on what God was doing through Jesus. Question for you to chew on this morning: are you in danger of missing out on what Jesus is doing because you've allowed your heart to become hardened, calloused, and unbelieving? As I've said before, if God is at work and we resist that work, he's going to take that movement somewhere else. Also, we see in this passage, another little observation here: when Jesus is on the move, true disciples follow him wherever. And in your notes there, you may want to outline that word, wherever. Okay? As Jesus withdrew from the synagogues, who follows right after him? Mark says his disciples did. Now think there for a minute about the risk these men were taking in order to follow Jesus. I mean, the synagogue was one of the core institutions of Jewish society. The synagogue represented respectability. It represented familiarity. It represented tradition. It represented loyalty to one's roots. Following Jesus meant they had to step away from all of that. Because these disciples trusted Jesus, because they had faith in him, they were willing to take that risk. That kind of faith, that kind of trust, is the essence of what it means to be a true disciple. As the old saying goes, wherever he leads, I'll go. You ever heard that one? We sing it all the time. Wherever he leads, I'll go. Of course, we usually add an addendum, unless it's someplace inconvenient. Now, a true disciple sings that and means it. Wherever he leads, I will go, because we trust him. You see, only faith, only that kind of faith, will sustain us when Jesus leads us away from the values and the expectations of a godless society is trying to impose on us. Let me give you just the most obvious example from our day and time is the example of sex. Okay, and I know people say, well, all you Christians are always talking about sex. No, it's only because the rest of the world keeps trying to rub our faces in it. Trust me, I would much rather talk about something else. But our society teaches that sex should be enjoyed whenever, however, and with whomever you want. No restrictions, no boundaries. In fact, we have completely divorced sex from the concept of marriage in our culture. Sex is just another thing a couple does together. It's like another recreational activity. In fact, right now, our society is working hard to divorce sex from actual biology, if you can figure that out. In contrast, Jesus calls us to respect sex as an awesome gift from God that nevertheless needs to be treated with respect and only enjoyed within a safe context. And as Jesus would teach us, that is a committed monogamous marriage between a man and a woman. But our world doesn't want to hear that. This is an obvious case where following Jesus is going to require you to swim against the cultural stream. Only a person who says, Jesus, I trust you, I believe that you're telling me the truth, is going to be able to withstand the pressure that society pushes on you to try to get you to conform to its mold. Somebody else has said, you know, Jesus is not looking for fans. He's looking for followers. You know, Tennessee didn't play yesterday, so I can't pick on Tennessee fans. But there were a lot of UTC fans that revealed their stripes about the third quarter in yesterday's game against the Citadel. I was almost one of them. I was about to turn it off. They were down by 3 touchdowns going into the fourth quarter. Guess what? For those of you who didn't stick around, they won. By 1 point, 28 seconds left. It ain't over till it's over. But the true faithful had faith that their team was going to pull it out, and they stayed with them to the very end. Jesus is looking for people that trust him enough to stay with him all the way through, no matter what the rest of the world's going to throw at him. That's what it means to be a disciple. Question, do you trust Jesus enough to follow him out of the comfortable, out of the convenient, out of the conventional? Another observation, the disciples aren't the only ones who are drawn to Jesus. When Jesus is at work, people will be drawn to him. We see that in verses 7 and 8. When Jesus withdrew into the countryside, Mark tells us a great multitude of people sought him out there. What's more, this great multitude of seekers was drawn not just from Galilee, not just from the neighborhood. They came literally from every corner of the nation. And Mark lists all the places these people came from. Judea represented the equivalent of 2 states over from Galilee, skipping over Samaria, probably because there wasn't a very heavy Jewish presence in that region. But this is like people from Illinois coming to Tennessee and skipping over Kentucky. Okay, that's how far away they're coming. Jerusalem represented the political, social, cultural, religious capital of the Jewish nation. Idumea represents the people of the nation of Edom, which had formerly existed in the area what we call today southern Jordan. But now these people, because of invaders, had migrated into the southernmost territory of Judea, what we call the Negev Desert. And that's where they were living. So they represent the southernmost reaches of Jewish territory. The people across the Jordan represented those Jewish towns and villages that were on the east side of the Jordan River, area that's normally called Perea from the Greek word for on the other side. And so they're over there. That represents the easternmost territory of the Jewish influence. And Tyre and Sidon are right on the Lebanese border today. So they represent, at that time, the northernmost, northwestern reaches of Jewish reach and territory. So people are literally coming from every corner of the nation to see what this business is with Jesus, this teacher they've heard about in Galilee. And remember, this was a day with no cell phones, no newspapers, and no CNN. The way this news was spreading was word of mouth from person to person as travelers from Galilee went to some of these places and said, man, you won't believe what's happening back where I came from. And people were so intrigued by what they heard, they were willing to travel great distances in order to see it for themselves. It's the same today. You let Jesus start doing something new in a community, and people want to know, hey, what is going on there? It's called revival. People are drawn to find out what's going on for themselves. And to be sure, not all of these people that were coming to hear Jesus were really being drawn to him for the right reasons. A large part of this crowd just came to see the spectacle. They'd heard about the miracles. They had loved ones who needed healing. They pressed around Jesus to try to get from him what they wanted. And as Mark will tell us later in his story, when the show was over, many of these very same people would turn against Jesus and call for his death. However, some of the people in that great crowd would be genuinely transformed by their encounter with Jesus. These people would believe in Jesus. They would accept his message. They would become disciples. Now, when Jesus was arrested and crucified, only about 120 of these people would be left out of this great multitude. But after Jesus was resurrected, that 120 people would form the nucleus of his church. What can we learn from that today? Well, we live in an era where churches are dying, left and right. I saw a stat this morning. Today, before the day is over, 7 Southern Baptist churches will close their doors for the last time. They're holding their final services today. That's the statistic. Most churches are either plateaued or declining. But as the Tennessee Baptist Mission Board has found out in their research, not all churches are closing, not all churches are declining. And the churches that are having the biggest evangelistic impact in our state right now are those who have unashamedly targeted the next generation. These are churches that are investing in technology. They're investing in modern music. They're investing in modern approaches to reaching people. And we have adopted some of those approaches ourselves. These churches are attempting to translate the timeless gospel of Jesus Christ into a cultural language that people today can understand, okay? Now, of course, there are some naysayers who go around and say, well, you know, that's just entertainment. You know, that's a valid criticism. Yeah, there are some people just being drawn to the show, but not all of them. Some people being drawn to the spectacle, and when the show's over, they're going to move on. But some of those people are going to stay because they are having a genuine encounter with Jesus Christ. I could introduce you to some of those people right here. You know, a little over 100 years ago, Dwight Moody, big evangelist, doing a lot of controversial things. Today he's remembered as one of the most effective evangelists of the 19th century. He was responding to one of his critics once, and he said this, "It is clear you don't like my way of doing evangelism." He went on, "You raise some good points. Frankly, sometimes I do not like the way I do evangelism, but I like my way of doing it better than your way of not doing it." Question this morning. Are we willing to do whatever it takes by any means necessary to share the good news about Jesus with as many people as we can who desperately need to hear this message in their own language? When we go across the seas, we learn Chinese and African dialects and European languages to share the gospel. In our culture, it may be English, but the way people approach the world and their view of the world might as well be a foreign language. Today, sociologists will tell you that thanks to the influx of technology in our culture, the gap between the greatest generation and Generation Z is almost like two different language groups. Are we willing to translate the gospel into a means they can hear? Just to take a slightly different direction here. When Jesus calls a person to follow him, he calls all of that person. In verse 9, he told his disciples to get a boat ready. Jesus calls for a boat to be prepared. He's being pressed in by so many people. It's inhibiting his ability to address them all. So he says, give me a boat ready as a makeshift platform from which he could address this crowd safely. This is the first of at least five occasions in Mark's gospel where Jesus called for a boat to be prepared for this purpose. Think about this. Why was that boat even there? The fact this boat was readily available implies that some of Jesus' disciples had not completely broken ties with their former occupation. Because after all, what were they? Fishermen. Right. So this speaks to a common misconception many people have about what it means to follow Jesus. Some people think that following Jesus means leaving behind everything from your old way of life, that there's only certain ways that you can serve him. It is true that sometimes Jesus does lead us away from certain elements of our past. However, Jesus also takes the way we are wired and uses it for his glory. There's an old story about a farmer who was convinced that God was calling him to preach. He had a sense of calling in his life, and in his mindset, the only way that could be manifested was to become a preacher. Now, his pastor, on the other hand, who knew him pretty well, didn't really see how this guy's gifts and abilities and approach to things really meshed up with that particular calling. So he was trying to steer him in other directions. And one day, the pastor dropped by to visit with the man. The man's out in his field plowing as they're talking, and while they're sitting there talking out in the middle of the field, a plane flies over and begins skywriting. P.C. And the farmer says, "You see that? You see that? That's a message from the Lord to me. Preach Christ." And the pastor said, "Have you ever thought maybe it means plant crops?" As the great reformer Martin Luther once said about, Martin Luther was a big believer that God has a vocation for every believer, a calling for every believer, that God uses us in whatever way he shaped us to bring glory to him. He once said, "A cobbler, a smith, a farmer, each has the work and office of his trade, and yet they are all alike, consecrated priests and bishops." See, the church in Martin Luther's, they taught the only way you could really serve God was to go into the monastery or go into the priesthood. He said, no, we are all called to be priests and proclaimers of the gospel. He says, "Everyone by means of his own work or office must benefit and serve every other, that in this way many kinds of work may be done for the bodily and spiritually welfare of the community, even as all the members of the body serve one another." Luther also went on to say, "The Christian shoemaker does his duty not by putting little crosses on shoes, but by making good shoes, because God is interested in good craftsmanship." Consider these questions. Where has God placed you so that you can serve as his witness? He's put you in a context. He's given you influence over a certain group of people. How does he intend to use that to be his witness in your circle? How has God uniquely shaped you? What experiences, what skills, what gifts has he given you to help you to share Jesus with others? How can you use those unique gifts to give God glory and point other people to Jesus? I had a wonderful experience Thursday. I was invited to a meeting, a select group of pastors. And I'm looking around the table wondering, why in the world am I here? I mean, there's pastors from some of the biggest churches in Chattanooga here. If I mention the names, you know who I'm talking about. And I'm sitting there going, man, why am I here? What it is one of our African-American churches in our association has gotten the vision to plant a community health clinic in one of the roughest neighborhoods in Hamilton County. They don't want it to be just their ministry. They want people to come alongside and partner with them. Well, you know, I'm looking around saying, well, I don't have any doctors or lawyers in my church, but I sure got a bunch of nurses and paramedics and medical techs. And sure enough, I've shared this with a couple of people, and they've already said, hey, sign me up, okay? They want to use their gifts, their skills to serve Jesus through this clinic. As soon as I get details, we'll let more of you know about it in case you want to get involved in that. But that's an example of taking how God has shaped you. If you're a nurse, if you're a paramedic, if you're a teacher, if you're a mechanic, if you're a bulldozer driver, however God has shaped you, whether it's in the classroom, the emergency room, the boardroom, the break room, or whatever, you are God's person in that place. Let him use you to point other people to Jesus. Finally, when Jesus' authority is revealed, even his enemies are forced to kneel in recognition. In verses 11 and 12, once again, we see Mark drawing a distinction between afflictions caused by physical illnesses and afflictions caused by spiritual oppression. People who are possessed by demons. And once again, we see these dark, malevolent spiritual entities recognizing Jesus as the Son of God. Actually, earlier they had referred to him chapter 1, verse 24 as the Holy One of God. Here they're calling him the Son of God. In Mark's gospel, these terms are synonymous. By falling down in front of Jesus, they are demonstrating they recognize in him an authority greater than their own. And once again, we see Jesus commanding these entities to stop proclaiming who he was. Why would he do that? Well, maybe it was because Jesus didn't want the primary witness to his messiahship to be coming out of such unholy mouths. Actually, I think it's probably because Jesus was already facing scrutiny from the authorities, and an open assertion of his messiahship might provoke a confrontation before the time was right. Of course, now we don't have that problem, because what was the last thing Jesus told his church? Go tell! So we don't have that excuse. He's taking it away from us. But think about what's going on here. Jesus is withdrawing from the religious establishment, these scholarly men who were leading the rest of their people to seek God. They don't recognize him, but everybody else did. Including the demons. The irony of Mark's description is that everyone seemed to acknowledge Jesus except those who were best equipped to recognize him. I mean, these religious authorities prided themselves in their devotion to God, their disciplined morality, their dedication to the scriptures. And even though Jesus continued to check off box after box after box from that messianic prophecy that they were so big on, they refused to recognize him because he didn't fulfill those prophecies in the way they had preconceived. One day there was a diver who was enjoying some scuba diving. He was about 20 feet below the surface and swimming around. And he looked around and there was a guy floating there, same depth he was, who didn't have on a scuba tank. So he thought that was kind of funny. So he went down about 20 feet deeper. And he turned around a minute. And there's this guy, no scuba tank, right down where he was. He's getting really confused. He goes down another 20 feet, and this man is coming down right on his level. So finally, he turns around. He takes his little waterproof dry erase board, and he writes, "How on earth are you able to stay under this deep with no scuba equipment?" And the other guy took the board, scratched on it. "I'm drowning, you idiot!" Like that diver, these religious leaders were missing the obvious. Only they were the ones drowning because of their ignorance and their stubbornness. How tragic to possess every spiritual advantage required to recognize Jesus' true identity and yet miss out because we refuse to submit ourselves to him. If you've been on the church since cradle roll, but your heart is hard, you can miss out on what Jesus is doing. Jesus stands before every one of us, and he calls out, "Follow me. If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." There's no middle ground there. You're either with Jesus or you're not. I have a plaque on my wall that says, "The road is full of flat squirrels who couldn't make up their mind." Neutrality is not an option when it comes to Jesus. But know this, if you decide to follow Jesus, don't be surprised if he leads you out of your comfort zone. If he leads you out of the familiar, out of the comfortable, out of the convenient. Do you have the faith to follow him there? Do you trust him enough to follow him where he's leading? Listen, I'm here to tell you, it's better to be with Jesus out in the wilderness than be in your safe little hole alone. Trust in Jesus. Find out where he's at work and join him there.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.